the last night that we were in Israel, before we were ready to return to the airport and come back, those of us who came back right away to the States, we had a dinner and we were joined by some 14 soldiers from the IDF, from the Israel Defense Forces. In the middle of the dinner, a 22-year-old young man came over to me and started to talk and told me he was from Connecticut. As soon as he graduated, 2 years ago, he made Aliyah. Right away, he trained and became a sharpshooter. And in his second year, he became part of counterterrorism units to capture suicide bombers and interrogate terrorists at the ripe old age of 22. We talked for a few minutes, and he told me a few stories, and I said to him, you know, give me your parents' phone number. I want to call them when I go back to the States and tell them that I saw you, that you're fine, that I spoke to you, and how much I admire you and what you're doing. So he gave me the number, and he said, here's the number. Let's hope my father answers and not my mother. Because my mother is nervous about all this. My father handles it better. So yesterday, I called, and his father answered. And we talked for a while, and he told me he has two other sons in the IDF. All three of his sons are there. And I told him how much I admire the fact that they raised them to do that and that they exist day to day with the knowledge of what their children are doing. And he said, most of the time it's all right. And most of the time we feel nothing but pride. But every now and then, one of the boys will call me, and he told me where they were all stationed, at least regularly. And he'll say, listen, Dad, don't tell Mom, but I'm going out on a mission, and I'll call you when I get home. And it reminded me that you never, never, never can trace all the filaments, all the implications, all the pain and anxiety and worry of this conflict that moves not only throughout Israel, but through the Jewish world. A father that we met on one of the army bases that we visited told me when his son calls, he said, I can't help but say to him, where are you? And his answer is, I'm in the army, Dad. Because he can't tell it. Part of the purpose of this trip was what Moshe says to God when he is on the wrong side of the Jordan and he asks God, please let me cross over and see. And the Kotzker Rebbe says, why does Moses say cross over and see? If you cross over, you see. But he said you can cross over and not see. It's possible to see things without really seeing them. It's possible to be there and miss what is going on, and we didn't want to miss what was going on. So we sat with the mayor of Sderot, and he told us how in his little town of 24,000 people, in the past 5 years, over 3,500 Qassam rockets have fallen. And apart from the injuries and apart from the death, you may be interested to know when most of them fall. Most of them fall between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, because that's when children are going to school. So he said, we have a town full of children who suffer post-traumatic stress. Teenagers who won't sleep in their own beds, who won't be alone in the dark. Adults who won't walk out of their home after sunset, and lots of other manifestations that you can imagine, especially in little children. We saw pictures drawn by children in some of the schools, one of which shows rockets coming out of the sky and little homes underneath. Another one shows a rocket that is launched into a heart and the heart is split in two. After all, this is their home. And, said the mayor, 5 years ago there were 24,000 people in Sderot. Today there are 24,000 people in Sderot. But even that show of resolve is not true in every city. You go to Kiryat Shmona or to Haifa, and it's almost like a ghost town. People aren't there. Because you know, and I know, that the rockets aren't coming into Haifa because they want Israel out of Lebanon. And they're not coming into Sderot so that they can have sovereignty over Gaza. And Hezbollah is not saying we will rain rockets on Tel Aviv because they want to hold democratic elections in Beirut. The world thinks it's foolish when we say this is an existential war, that this is a war for Israel's survival, but it depends how close you put the lens. If the lens is only like a microscope on Hezbollah and Israel, does Hezbollah right now threaten the destruction of Israel? Of course not. But just pull the lens back a bit, and all of a sudden, it will take in Iran and Syria, and an Egypt that is threatened by the Muslim Brotherhood, and whatever may result in Iraq, and Hamas, and all of a sudden, the idea of an existential war doesn't only sound plausible, it sounds certain. We met with the mayor of Haifa. Haifa is Israel's third largest city. Haifa is the city where Jews and Arabs have lived together in peace since the founding of the state. After 1948, the first mayor of Haifa was an Arab, not a Jew. Haifa is the site of the Baha'i Temple. Haifa is a city besieged. And you can only imagine if the third largest city in the United States, Chicago, were being attacked by missiles from Canada, and the Canadian government said, there's nothing we can do to stop this group. How quickly you think we would turn to the UN? So it is a very fraught and very difficult situation. But of course, it's not so much the politics that we went to see, because that you can see online, on TV, in the newspaper. All you have to do is know the background and read between the lines. We went to see the people. We went to walk through Rambam Hospital and see soldiers. And when I say soldiers, another way to think of that is to see 18-year-old boys, 19-year-old boys, with their mother and father and sisters and brothers gathered around their bed, who've been shot in the spine or in the face, or who've been near a grenade when it goes off, or a rocket. Who are going to go through multiple surgeries in the hope of some normalcy, to see a soldier whose legs were amputated days before sit there and play the guitar and sing for us. And to see again and again and again that their reaction to our presence was such gratitude that we were there that it made me feel ashamed. Because what they should be saying in Rambam and in Hadassah and in Tel HaShomer and in all the wonderful hospitals in Israel, in Sheba, what they should be saying is, oh my God, another delegation from America. All right, come on in. That isn't what they're saying. They're saying, wow, this is wonderful, a delegation from America. We're not alone. One of the patients was introducing the doctor who had saved his life. And we started to talk to the doctor, and he began to explain to us that they know exactly by the angle that a sniper fire goes through a face or a neck immediately whether someone will survive. So somebody in our group said, it must have taken you a lot of terrible experiences to learn this. He said, yeah, the first experience was with my son in Lebanon in 1996. He said, when they brought him in, we didn't think he was going to live. We saved him, and that's how we learned how to do it. Again and again and again, what we see on television was made real, was made powerful. And there was the realization that you cannot live this way. That without, for a moment, deciding what the correct military strategy is, it's clear that this is a country that he's surrounded not just by people who would destroy it, but by people who, because they cannot yet destroy it, will do everything they can to make living there as painful, as nerve-wracking, as frightening as possible. We went to a small makeshift camp that was set up for Ethiopian children. These children made Aliyah a month ago. They don't speak Hebrew. They don't speak English. And while their parents are in Haifa learning how to be Israeli citizens and trying to make their way in a new land, they sent their children to this camp so that they would be safe. So they're new immigrants, they don't speak the language, and they don't have their parents. Nobody reports this. Nobody knows this. One of the most moving and beautiful things that I saw on the entire trip was as we gathered around, and one of the madrichim, one of the counselors who runs the camp, was singing with them. We took his guitar, gave it to Craig Taubman. He had all the children gather around him, and we all sang. And they sang, and they clapped, and a couple of the counselors set up a limbo string, and they began to dance limbo underneath it, and for a moment, they smiled, and they made cards for us that said, in very beautiful, if broken English, how glad they were we were here, with little hearts and little Israeli flags. What kind of memories are these kids going to have of their land without their parents, without their home? Where they come to a new place and the first thing that happens a week after coming is rockets fall from the sky. These are children, Jewish children. And people said, are you afraid to go? It's so terrible. I would go, but it's frightening. And I think to myself, what about the kids in Sderot? We went in, we met with the mayor, we left. They got to go to school tomorrow morning. We were in a hotel in Jerusalem. They were in a bunker in Kiryat Shmona. For Jews to have to live in bunkers is nauseating. It's disgusting. We know what it is to live in bunkers. We know what it is to live in camps. And the point of Israel was we should never have to do that again. That was why we had an Israel. And so it was these soldiers, these kids, that were defending the collective dream not only of Israel but of all of us as well. There was a time, you know, in Jewish history when the soldier was a symbol of evil. Look at the medieval Haggadot. When you want to see the wicked son is a soldier. But now they stand on the front lines of defending the Jewish people. And I kept asking myself, really, is there anybody in this world who is not blind, who is not evil, who thinks the world would be better off if only in Lebanon Hezbollah could run a state? That's really what the world needs. Is there anybody who believes that? And if you don't believe it, then don't you realize that the only thing that is preventing that is that 18-year-old kid? Believe me, Kofi Annan is not going to prevent it. We had a meeting with the secretary of the prime minister, Yisrael Maimon. We talked about all sorts of things, especially Hasbara, which means Israel's public relations, which are as poor as its cause is good. And he told us a powerful story. This is a story that I wrote in the dispatches that I wrote from Israel, and by the way, send out things every week, and if you want to be on the mailing list, just contact the office and we'll be more than happy to put you on the mailing list for the brief message that I send out each week, and you can also get all the dispatches that were written from Israel. But he told us about this woman named Mrs. Micheli, who was for 20 days in a bunker in Kiryat Shmona with her 6 children. And the cabinet minister, Marit Danon, was walking through the bunkers to give encouragement and support to those who were there. And Mrs. Micheli grabbed the cabinet minister and said, "I demand to speak to the prime minister." And she said, "Well, you know, it's the middle of a war, the prime minister is kind of busy, but it's very hard to say no to a mother with 6 children." She said, "I've been in this bunker for 3 weeks, and believe me, the bunkers are very rudimentary. And they're hot, and they're uncomfortable." And they got the prime minister on the phone. And he said, "Yes, Mrs. Micheli, what can I do for you?" And she said, "Mr. Prime Minister, I have only one message for you." He said, "What?" She said, "Don't stop." So that's the message. Don't stop. Now, I don't mean this morning for us, don't stop the military action. That's not our province right now. I mean, don't stop what we do. Don't stop giving money. Believe me, when this war is over, those kids, those soldiers, they're going to need a lot. They're going to need to rebuild the infrastructure of a lot of these cities. You should see what the Katyushas not only do to a building, but you know, they fill them with ball bearings. Little metal balls just in the hope that if the bomb doesn't hit you, something will hit you to ruin your life. And so when you look across the street from where the bombs hit, there are pockmarked buildings that look as if 1,000 bullet holes were fired in them, but it's all from the dispersal of these ball bearings in the bomb. Israel's going to need a lot of help in the hospitals, for the soldiers, for the children, psychological services, social services. And they can't do it all by themselves. And not only that, but they shouldn't do it by themselves, because they're doing it for us, so we should be doing it for them. There are lots of fundraising drives going on now. The Federation and UJA are raising millions and millions of dollars. On Monday night, the Iranian Federation is having an event. And we here at Sinai Temple have raised over $1 million, and I want to raise a lot more. And if we raise enough, we'll go back again. Because they need to see that we are there. We need to give money to the soup kitchens, to the psychological services, to the hospitals, to the clinics, to the infrastructure, to the programs, to the schools. There was a school that we saw that had almost no buildings for the school, but they had concrete bunkers for the kids to run into in the middle of the day when the rockets fall. I want to go back there and help them build a school, now that they've already got the huge slabs of concrete. And that's what the bunkers are. They're giant slabs of concrete with a hole to run into. That's where Jews are living in the year 2006 in the Jewish homeland. And we can't stop the rockets, but we can support the people who are helping. We went to army bases and we took these little packages. They had deodorant and food and medicine and toothbrushes and snacks and candy. I mean, nothing. The kind of thing that if you brought it up to your kid at camp, they'd look at it and say, "This is all you brought me?" And we gave them out to the soldiers, and you would have thought we were showering gold on them. They were so grateful, and we were so guilty. But they weren't grateful for what was in the bag. They were grateful that anybody bothered to go out to this sweltering heat and hand something to a soldier. But of course, then we got back on the air-conditioned bus. Whatever we give, it's nothing. It's nothing compared to what that parent in Connecticut is giving, compared to what that soldier in Rambam is giving. It's nothing. I'm not going to do what I did before and ask people to volunteer and to stand up and to give money. I'm not going to. We did that once. God knows we may do it again. But I gotta believe that you know what is needed, and that if you gave, you'll give again. And that either here, or at the Federation, or at the Iranian Federation, or wherever, that you will be writing a check, and you'll be doing it soon. Because the need is great. At Chazon Yeshayahu, which is a soup kitchen that we have supported before and will support again, hundreds and hundreds of kids and families are coming down from the north, and they need food. Nobody has a job. No stores are open. Nothing is coming in. Parents can't feed their kids. Israel's social services are strained to the limit. Where are they going to look? What country in the world is going to say, "Let's rush aid over to Israel. They're in trouble"? It's our job. We're supposed to be doing this. Maimonides, Rambam, in the Middle Ages, traveled all over the world, and the Middle Ages was an era of unimaginable poverty. And he said he never in his life saw a Jewish community without a communal chest for people who were hungry or who were in trouble to take money. In other words, we are supposed to be exactly what the Talmud says, rachamim b'nei rachamim, merciful people and the children of merciful people. Which means that we got to raise more money, and we got to encourage more groups, and we've got to go again and again. And when people come home, don't act as though they just walked through fire. They didn't. They just came back from Israel. Danny Gordas, speaking to us the very first night, said, people will ask you, did you feel safe? He said, and of course you'll feel safe, but yes is not the right answer. What you say to them is, the question isn't, did I feel safe? The question is, did I stand with the Jewish people? And the answer is yes. That's the question. Life is not actually a quest for safety. Life is a quest for meaning and for purpose. You're not supposed to do something safe with your life. You're supposed to do something important with your life. Which doesn't mean that you should be reckless, but it does mean that you should stand with those who are in trouble, even if it causes you a little trouble. So what I came to say this morning is we have just begun. Over the next weeks and months in this synagogue, as in the Jewish community, we will be doing more. I don't know exactly who or when we'll be going, but we'll be going again. I don't know how much more we will raise, but I hope we will raise millions. And I hope the Iranian Federation will raise millions. And I hope UJA Federation will raise tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions. And let me tell you that it'll be a drop in the bucket. But every single child who is helped, every soldier who is visited, every ambulance we purchase makes a difference. I really think those 30 Ethiopian children will remember that in the midst of the war, all of a sudden, all these Americans showed up to dance with them. That those soldiers will remember that when they lay in the hospital, that Americans came and their rabbis prayed with them. That the people in the bunker will know that they are not alone in a world that too often makes them feel alone. We are the luckiest Jewish community that has ever lived. Ever. If you grew up in this country, or even if you live in this country now, and you live in this place, you're safe, you're free, your belly is full, and you have a land of Israel. But every blessing in our tradition imposes a responsibility. Our Talmud teaches if you eat a piece of fruit and you don't say a blessing, you're a thief. Because you stole from God the one thing that God wants from you, which is gratitude. So that's what I'm asking for. Gratitude. you and I both know, deep inside yourself, that check that you write, in 5 years, you'll never know the difference. Maybe in 1 week, you won't know the difference, but God knows in 5 years, you won't know the difference. You won't even remember how much you gave. But those kids in Sderot, in 5 years, it will have made all the difference. So I'm asking you, on their behalf, to do tzedakah, which means righteousness, to go, to send money, to do what Mrs. Micheli told us, don't stop. We need more. We have to take care of the Jewish people, because if we don't, nobody will. Because we are here this morning in part because they are there. Because there's a 22-year-old kid from Connecticut who could have gone to graduate school or Wall Street. But instead, he waits on the border to grab the next suicide bomber whose aim in life is to kill Jews. I don't want him thanking me. I want to thank him. And since we can't stand there with him, we can give him our presence, we can give him our money, we can give him our support. We don't do it because we are good people, although we are good people. We do it because it's right. And we do it because ultimately what we know to be true is that that kid is not just defending Israel. And he's not just defending the Jewish people. He's defending the civilized values of the world that we cherish. And if he falls, and others like him fall, so do those values. And it plunges the world back into the chaos from which we have wrested it at the cost of our lives. So I don't only ask you, I beg of you, don't stop. Give, and give again, and give some more. Because when we needed him, he was there. And now, he needs us. And it's our turn to say Hineni. We are here. We are ready. We understand the charge from the people of Israel, from the state of Israel. And we appreciate the blessings of our history and the promise of our God. Shabbat Shalom.